Hope you're having a great Monday morning. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. We're going to start the show by talking a little about telemedicine with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Lori is a physical therapist and an athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. And Lori, good to have you back.
It's good to be here, Larry.
Jill with us as well. Jill's Tyne Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Jill, I'm hoping to hear your voice.
I'm here. How are you?
I'm doing just great. I hope you're doing well as well. So as we talk with these two experts, what questions do you have? Maybe about, let's start about virtual visits, how they work. Have you had experience with that? Do you need advice from a physical therapist? Maybe you've got an ache, a pain, or so forth. That can work, too. Join in the conversation. Give a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And, you know, when I go to see Dr. Sossman, my doctor, they weigh me first, and then they take my blood pressure and poke and prod around a little bit. But none of that's going to happen at a telemed visit, is it, Jill?
Well, I'll let Lori talk a little
bit first, Lori, about that,
and then I'll talk a little bit about what the WPTA is doing with telemed.
Okay.
All right. So you're absolutely right. We are not going to be able to place our hands physically on the patient. And there are many what we call contextual factors that are part of a face-to-face visit, whether it's with your physical therapist, your occupational therapist, your speech therapist, your physician, whomever. And that is the sense of being in a clinic, of being in that medical facility, the treatment table, just the whole scenario that is missing when you are sitting in the comfort of your own home. So it's really important, first of all, that your provider encourage and bring forth that level of professionalism that you would expect with a face-to-face visit. Sometimes it's easy to get casual because you are sitting in the comfort of your own home, but it's important that providers continue to provide that professional environment for that telemed visit. And you also need to consider the level of care that you need. So there are some cases where you really need to be seen face-to-face. You need your provider to physically put their hands on you and feel things, to feel the movement as you forward flex at your spine, to feel your knee as you move it through a range of motion, things that just don't happen well over telemed. So, having a visit or two face-to-face with telemed follow-ups, I think, makes sense as long as you are progressing in a linear fashion and not having any setbacks. So I think, not unlike conversations about school, thinking about telemed as a hybrid, I think, makes sense. Some face-to-face and some virtual.
Okay. What can they actually do? Can you set up your screen so the person lifts their leg or moves their wrist, or can they do anything of that nature?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it works best if you have a second person there who can hold the camera and video, and you can have your patient step back and observe their posture. You can have them, squat, raise their arms overhead, reach behind the back of their head, just like you might do in a clinic. The thing that's missing is your ability to put your hands on them and yourself move them through the range of motion. So, for example, at times, a patient may not be able to move, for example, their hip through a certain range of motion, but if they relax, you might be able to passively move it through the range, and that gives you different information.
Sure,
so,
that makes
so
sense.
We, So that's missing. But yes, you can, and you can have them get down on the floor. You know, can you do a cobra? Can you get on your hands and knees and rock or whatever? And you can have them perform different movements or exercises.
I think that the hybrid model that Lori spoke to works very well. If, particularly for the first visit, the patient is able to come into the clinic and you can do all those hands-on things so the therapist has a good feel, and I mean that literally and figuratively,
sure,
of the patient, then, you know, the therapist would start them on an exercise program. Then perhaps follow-up visits may flow a little bit better because the therapist already has that underlying knowledge of what they felt when they placed their hands on the patient. So that nice hybrid model that Lori spoke to, I think works really well. And then the other thing is just switching gears a little bit. When seeing, if you're going to see a physician, there are some things that lend themselves much better to telemedicine than others. And I have a great example. My daughter had a kind of a mole on her face. And of course, that works very well for our primary care physician to see. So we set up a telemed visit with our primary care physician, and we had good lighting, good background, and the physician was able to see it well enough. You know, she had my daughter push on it, things like that. We sent her a couple still photos. She asked for that to be uploaded through MyChart and made the decision that, you know what, we should send you to dermatology and have dermatology actually touch it and feel it. So then our follow-up visit was with dermatology where we could actually get in, see her, and we found out it was nothing. But that was a really nice use of, I think, telemedicine.
Yeah, that's a really good use of it for sure.
Right.
Well,
yeah, and additionally, for that face-to-face visit, that first visit, as Jill suggested, if there are going to be any equipment needs that patient might need at home, that would be an opportunity for the therapist to have the patient try those and say, you know, how does this work for you? Do you need an exercise ball? How are these resistive bands for you? And they can try different things that the patient can then either purchase or can be issued from the clinic and so on, so that they have whatever tools they need to be successful at home.
And the Wisconsin Physical Therapy Association, is actually having a hour and a half webinar for the physical therapists in the state of Wisconsin discussing the best practices in telehealth. So just know, as a consumer, the professional organizations are trying to do everything they possibly can to help guide healthcare professionals to truly maximize the visit and the time. So it's not only good from the patient perspective, but it's also good from the healthcare provider's perspective as well.
And are most of the offices offering telemedicine at this point? As you look around the state, do you know? Doctor's offices as well as the physical therapy offices?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, UW has been doing telemed since March. So UW was well positioned at the start of the pandemic to transition very quickly into telemed for their patients. So they had the infrastructure in place. They had policy in place. And so things transitioned very quickly. And over the last few months, we have resumed in the clinic face-to-face, but most staff are doing a hybrid model where there are some patients coming in for face-to-face treatments, and oftentimes follow-ups are via telemed. And that makes perfect sense. And again, if the patient is progressing as the patient and the staff think they should be progressing, then continuing telemed makes a lot of sense. It improves the patient's self-efficacy. They feel more confident in their ability to manage this. They know that they have someone has their back if they need it, but they begin to self-manage. If things are not going as expected, then they would pull that patient back into the clinic, re-examine, see if we need to switch gears.
And the other beautiful thing about telemedicine is, as Lori said, if you instruct somebody on an exercise in the clinic that first day, they might not have the exact setup at home, but they have something that they think is as good. So now, as a therapist, you have an opportunity to see exactly how your patient is performing their exercises at home or what equipment they have available to them, which is ideal. So it is the hybrid is a really nice model.
Some people, you know, I would think some people might worry about this being just a little too impersonal. Is that something you've heard from any patients?
I have not heard that at all from patients. We either do phone visits or we do video visits, and that is a patient preference. So we are seeing our patients face-to-face via video, and it's one-on-one just like it would be in the clinic. So it is personal, and frankly, unlike some clinic situations where you may have several staff and patients in the room in a large room at the same time, this is really one-on-one in one room. So you do have your staff's undivided attention. Right.
That makes a lot of sense. Hadn't thought about that. A little tougher with the kind of work you do often, Laura, with the pool.
Pool, yeah. Yes, so few people have that pool at home, but I've been back face-to-face since June because the pool is actually an ideal place to social distance. We have limited the number of patients in our pool to no more than four at a single time, and because the patient is in the pool and the staff are on the pool deck, we are really a minimum of 6 feet away from our patients, and you're in a chlorinated environment, so it's pretty clean.
All right. Well, Peter in Trimble, Wisconsin, has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Larry. Thanks very much for your wonderful program. I have been about some calf pain I'm getting in my Achilles tendons. I started doing some general stamina working out, like walking and jogging and biking a couple of months ago. And then about a month ago, I mixed in some stretching and strength activities, and my Achilles tendon started to get very sore in the morning, and now I still get it. You know, I started resting. I laid off of that. But when I ride the tractor around doing some mowing for a couple hours, when I get up out of the tractor, I can, you know, it's difficult to walk and to get those Achilles tendons stretched and are stretched out to where they don't hurt anymore. Did you have some suggestions about, you know, I've read some things about Achilles tendons. If you get them strained, you have to worry about, you know, resting them so you can avoid Achilles tendon rupture. Which are hurting.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, Jill, do you want to take that?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned specifically riding in the tractor seems to make them worse, or it's you really sore after that. Is it because you're in the tractor for a prolonged period of time, or is it because your feet are positioned in an unusual position in the tractor, Peter? Do you have any thoughts on that? Just trying to sort through this.
Well, I think it's just due to time. You know, sitting in the tractor, my feet are pretty well just kind of straight underneath, you know, where your hip and your knee both make 90-degree turns, and it's pretty much just a straight sit.
Okay, so it's probably the prolonged sitting, and so you sit and you're stiff, and you get up and you feel stiff.
Yeah, and okay. Also, if he's at 90 degrees, he could be putting some traction on his Achilles tendon.
Sure.
Rather than if he's in a little bit of plantar flexion.
That's true. Yep.
So,
did you change shoes or anything like that, or incorporate more hills in your walking or your jogging, Peter? That could have put a little bit more load on your Achilles.
Yeah, a little bit, and a little bit of speed too. I had a pretty good level of kind of basic fitness, and I wanted to try to notch it up a little bit.
Sure.
And so I started doing some stretching and, step ups and more hill work. Yep.
Okay. Yeah, my guess is it was probably the hill work or speed work, because when you're running uphill, you are putting your Achilles tendon on stretch, and then you're asking it to propel you uphill. When you're running downhill, your Achilles tendon is decelerating you as you come down. So as your knee is bending, your Achilles is actually doing a lot of that deceleration, and that's a heavy load on your Achilles tendon. So my guess is that that activity sort of puts you over the top.
Yep.
So, resting. So let's back up. Achilles tendinopathy along with patellar tendinopathy at your knee are two of the most difficult tendinopathies to recover from because you use those tendons every time you take a step. So I'll see what Jill has to say, but in my experience, I recommend people be seen for this and get put on a very structured program to help them recover because, as you said, there is a risk of rupture. You have it in both Achilles and you're an active guy. I would get guidance on this to return to activity and recover from this. Jill, what do you think?
I would 100% agree. And if between now and when you see your physical therapist, Peter, if you can even pinpoint a little bit better pattern of things you think makes it worse and things you think makes it better, that will help guide your physical therapist in designing a good program for you because, as Lori said, rest is good, but we don't want to completely stop activity if we don't have to. We want you to do some sort of activity. So if we can find things that you can do that will keep you somewhat active but not irritate your Achilles that you can do kind of while your Achilles is recovering, that would be ideal because we don't want to shut you down completely if we don't have to.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call,
yeah,
Peter.
Great question.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jill Tine Nissenbaum, Lori Tine Brody, our guest today, Natalie Guyette, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at physical therapy kinds of issues today, we've talked a bit about telemed versus in-person visits or accompanied with in-person visits with our two guests today. Jill Tine Nissenbaum, Associate Professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy Program, Lori Tine Brody, Physical Therapist and an Athletic Trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. A lot of uncertainty about what the fall school year is going to be looking like, especially with sports. I know the Big Ten College Football Conference is postponing their events and season. I imagine, I know, because of my daughter, a lot of sports for kids of all ages are kind of on hold. Some are going forward. What do you think our kids are going to need in the way of different ways to get exercise in?
Well, that's a great question. And as you mentioned, Larry, the Big Ten is one of two of the Power Five conferences that have, for lack of better terms, hit the pause button on fall sports. There's three conferences that are so far, as of this moment in time, continuing to push forward. But as we know, that can change very quickly. What typically happens is the high schools typically follow what the university institutions do. We kind of see this trickle-down effect all the way through from collegiate sports to high school sports to middle school sports. So the challenges with the high schools are different conferences have schools in different counties. Different counties in the state may have different policies. Some states have statewide policies with regards to mask and everything else. Some conferences actually cross borders and have some teams in Illinois and some teams in Wisconsin. So it becomes very challenging in how you're going to navigate this. In addition, some sports actually kind of lend themselves to social distancing while other sports don't. The analogy our team physician gives, for example, if you're going to be a cross country runner, you want to be in first place. Because you don't want to be in the middle of the pack because, you know, that's a little tighter pack. So there are some sports that lend better than others. So having said all that, the fear of the unknown, which as adults, you know, weighs very heavily on us, I think weighs even harder on kids from a mental and emotional perspective. So I think the best thing we can do is make sure our children get some sort of physical activity, whether it's related to the sport they anticipate on performing in the fall or not, That is very important. One of my daughter's friends runs is a cross-country runner, and they're moving forward with kind of a cross-country running routine, a training routine that they're doing by themselves or with a friend, social distancing, 6 feet apart while they run. And they're going to kind of continue doing that. So they have some emotional support because they're doing it with a friend, and then also the physical release, but still don't know whether their sport's going to occur or not. So there's still that unknown.
Yeah,
so it becomes
my daughter's
very
in the same boat.
Right. Yeah, it becomes very difficult. And Lori's kids play a team sport, which is entirely different.
Right. My boys are soccer players. And so, you know, who knows what's going to happen, but I don't see a soccer season for them. They're in the Madison Metropolitan School District. So it's not going to happen. They also play club. They play with the 56ers, and they are holding practices. We are restarting again this week. What they've done is they've created a grid of 10-foot squares, and you stay in your 10-foot square. Athletes are masked. And if you are out at all for any reason, or if you're out due to COVID, you need doctor's letter authorizing you to return. So I had a doctoral student who just finished his dissertation on training. So my boys asked me, well, what's better? Should I go out for a run or should I go to the field and do some ball work? And his research showed that in terms of your cardiorespiratory fitness and your performance on a 30-meter run, doing soccer-specific drills was equally as good as running sprints and was more enjoyable. So the kids were surprised.
I would agree.
So the kids were more willing to participate. They enjoyed it more. They were more motivated to participate when they did the soccer drill. So basically they were running the same thing, but they threw a ball in. They threw in a ball and a defender and a goalie, and they enjoyed it much more. So figuring out a way with a couple kids, social distance, to get out there and participate in the activity that you love, not necessarily going out for a long run by yourself. You lose that really important social aspect, which is so important to kids.
What about the kid who's maybe not in a sport? How much exercise should they be getting a week? Or even the kids who are in?
150 minutes a week.
Per the American College of Sports Medicine Guidelines.
Sports Medicine Guidelines, 150 minutes a week. So that's generally across the board. So, and you have to figure out what you enjoy doing. You know, if you're an older person, you know, you're working on potentially balance, spatial awareness, as well as strength, cardiorespiratory, and flexibility. If you're younger, I encourage people to do things they enjoy. If you like yoga, do yoga. If you like dance aerobics, find videos online and maybe with a friend, socially distancing, doing something that you like to do.
And the other interesting thing Lori had talked about when she was talking about the soccer drills and the 10 by 10 squares and the athletes wearing masks, the whole mask usage, it's very interesting. Even at the collegiate level, the first day you put an athlete in a mask, they feel, oh, this is really uncomfortable. I don't really like it. By day two or day three, they are very comfortable with it. So it's interesting how quickly they feel they can adapt to it. So making sure they have a mask that's well-fitted and comfortable is key. But we have found that people can adapt to wearing a mask and performing physical activity pretty well.
All right.
Absolutely.
Let's take another call. Christina in Glenwood City, we'll give you a chance now. Thanks for calling.
Hi there. Thank you. I have a curiosity question. I'm an athletic 62-year-old, and I sit on my couch with a back support for alignment, and I always cross my right leg over my left leg. And I was wondering if I could have long-term effects from doing this. Could I switch it up or do something different?
So it, I guess part that's a great question. And it's so funny. We were just having this conversation in the athletic training room the other day that I've been practicing physical therapy for 26, 27 years now. And when I demonstrate an exercise, I almost always demonstrate it on my right leg or using my left arm. And I have started to feel a difference. So now I have to kind of undo my little sidedness and kind of keep things even. So I guess if you sit for prolonged hours at a time or, you know, over years and years, it's probably a good thing to switch it up. In reality, you shouldn't cross your legs. Let's start with that because it can compress some of the your popliteal artery and some of the arteries in the back of your knee. When you cross your right leg over your left, it would kind of compromise blood flow on the right side. So in the ideal world, we would sit with both feet flat on the floor. Lori, do you want to add anything?
Yes. So I had a flashback to swimming, and I was a left-sided breather, and I decided it's really not good to be turning my head the same direction, to breathe on the same side. And so I forced myself to learn to breathe on the other side, and I feel like I am now more symmetrical because I do that. Similarly, as we get into the fall and you think about raking, you think about sweeping, you think about vacuuming, I think it's useful to train your body to do things using the other side, because I do think that you tend to overuse things when you do the things same-sided all the time. Same thing with shoveling snow. I've taught myself to shovel with my other hand because I think it's useful to change things up that way. Whether there's no evidence to support that, to me it's just biologic plausibility.
Right, exactly.
There you go, Christina. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. You can join in too, by the way, with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Amanda from Middleton is a delivery driver and has been experiencing pain under the ball of her right foot. Any recommendations for treating or stretches for someone who drives a lot?
Well, I'm wondering if she has a little bit of sesamoiditis. She's probably, if it's her right foot, she's probably constantly stepping on the gas with that foot, Lori. And so, and there's the in and out of the truck all the time for those UPS drivers. So if she's constantly, for example, like putting her right foot up on the fender or the back of the truck and hoisting herself in, or constantly jumping out kind of more and landing on her right foot, that could probably give her a bit of sesamoiditis.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be sesamoiditis. It could also be her metatarsal arch or a neuroma. So those would probably be the big three contenders in the ball of your foot, the sesamoiditis, neuroma, or metatarsal arch issue. In any case, I'd suggest that she be seen, because based upon that information, we don't know which of those it is, and we would want to examine her foot. So, for example, if she was flat-footed and was placing a lot of pressure on that first big toe joint where those sesamoids are, or it could be her first MTP joint as well.
Right.
Then that intervention would differ than if it was, for example, a neuroma between her second and third metatarsals or something like that. So I'd suggest she be seen, particularly because this is interfering with her vocation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep. That's a big deal. They're busy right now.
I was thinking about it, and I always start with my right foot. And I wonder if she's getting in and out of the truck all the time with starting with the one foot.
Yep. We see that a lot. We see that quite a bit, because there might be a hand railing where you hold on with your left hand, and so you automatically put your right foot up first. So that is not uncommon to see those conditions. I remember many years ago, one of our physicians showed us a picture of somebody with an incredibly arthritic right hip. His left hip hip prostrine and his right hip was incredibly worn out. And he was a truck driver who always got in and out of the truck the same way for 30 years. And that in and of itself was enough to cause all these arthritic changes in his hip.
Man.
So going back to Christina's comments about should I, cross my leg the other way, changing up your movement patterns from the way you do things day in and day out, I think is useful.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think Amanda should see somebody about this.
Right.
This is too important.
Right.
Yeah. Rick in Baraboo, we're on to you now. Hi, Rick.
Hi. I'm just calling to make a comment regarding, I think it was Pete or Peter and his Achilles tendonitis.
Yes.
I was an exercise and sports science professor for many years. And I eventually, with my running, ended up having Achilles tendonitis in both ankles. It was bad enough that I actually had to stop running for a couple of years until I realized, because I coach wrestling in the wintertime, wearing my wrestling shoes, which are very flat, and I would run with the kids, that by the end of the wrestling season, my Achilles felt really good. And then I'd go back to my regular running shoes, and it would get worse. And I realized that part of the problem was is the difference in the heel drop. So kind of against all conventional wisdom, I went and started tried out some minimalist style running shoes that have between a 0 and 4 millimeter heel drop instead of a typical 10 to 12 millimeter heel drop. And it's made a huge difference. It's been, unfortunately, because I hate running, I've been able to do it for the next, for another 9-10 years. So maybe Pete needs to try that, and especially if he's wearing work boots all day,
right,
and hasn't paid really attention or doesn't have the knowledge about the different shoes, you got to start out slow. And you got to do walking in them and things like that. But it's pretty amazing what the changes to my feet have been. I've flat-footed and an over-pronator my whole life. I actually now, after the first 5 years, I actually have arches in my feet. And the muscular development in my calves is completely different. So maybe give that a try.
So those are great comments. And that's one thing with the minimalist shoes that you're describing, Rick, is that you have to use your foot intrinsic so much. And so
you
talk about developing the arch, you're using muscles that perhaps a different shoe didn't have you use. So that's a great point. The other thing you had mentioned, which I thought was interesting, was, running in the wrestling shoes. Were you running on the mats? Because then not only do you have to think about the shoe, but you also have to think about the surface, which is something we didn't discuss with Peter either, is kind of the surface he's on, but maybe the ground surface is a factor as well.
We would run, on the mat more a little bit as warm-ups, but we do some endurance training and sprint training out, in hallways and stuff like that. That was a hard surface.
Yes.
Wow. And I naturally, in those situations, I tended to protect my heel because it kind of hurts running in wrestling shoes on a hard surface. So I would do more midfoot striking.
Sure.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, that's great.
So that's one of the things that we've discovered with minimalist shoes. And if you go back to the whole body of literature on minimalist shoes and why sometimes people got better, it wasn't necessarily the shoe itself, but the fact that they changed how they ran, just like you described.
Right.
So is it really the shoe, or is it that they changed their stride? They tend to shorten their stride, and they tend to do more of a midfoot or midfoot to forefoot landing rather than a rear foot. So the other thing that I love, Rick, is you have really laid bare the challenge in dealing with these tendinopathies, because there are 25 variables that you have to consider. So it's not just you have Achilles tendinopathy, yes or no, or that every person with a tendinopathy gets treated the same. That's why we tell people you really need to come in and be seen. It's not like we're trying to generate business. I tell you, we're plenty busy.
Right.
But that there are so many individual factors that contribute to this, and there is no one-size-fits-all for people. You have to take this patient by patient. And your description of your shoes and the use of, for example, heavy slow resistance in treating tendinopathies, that's a painful heavy lifting that also seems counterintuitive, seems to be highly successful for many people. So
Rick made a
very individualized
his own single subject study.
Exactly.
That's right. Rick, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
Appreciate your call. Well, Doug in Onalaska, it's your turn. Hi, Doug.
I'm a fairly fit guy, almost 70. I walk 3 miles a day with the dog, and I work out light weights, and I do a lot of squats, a lot of lunges, things like that. And the back of my left knee is sore, and I don't feel it when I'm working out or walking. But after the fact or at different times of the day, if I've squatted or I'm standing up or I'm kneeling on the floor and I come up, it hurts and my knee feels weak. And it's like I'm almost shaking to get up. And I'm just, and it's only on the back of one knee. And I'm just wondering what might be causing that.
Well, it could be a couple things. My first thought is a Baker cyst. My second thought would be some sort of hamstring tendinopathy or hamstring irritation. Is it more, does it feel kind of deep in the joint, or does it feel like it's one of those tendons kind of on the outside of the back of your knee?
If you bend the knee at a 90-degree angle or a right angle, it feels like it's right in the middle, deeper into the knee, into the back of the knee.
Okay. So my guess is that you have a small degenerative tear of the posterior horn of your meniscus. So when you squat, that's going to load the meniscus or cartilage in the back of your knee. My guess is if it was a tendonitis, it would hurt you more often.
Right.
With activity. Yeah. So do you feel any swelling at all in your knee or swelling in the back of your knee? You feel any little, you know, bubble kind of thing in the back of your knee?
I don't feel a bubble, but there have been a couple of times I felt that it felt a little fat.
Okay.
Okay.
So it could be some swelling in the back of your knee. So as Jill said, it could be a little Baker cyst or it could be a meniscal tear. Are you squatting down to 90 degrees?
Yes.
Yeah, I'd probably try not squatting quite so far and try to avoid loading the structures on the back of your knee. You know, at nearly age 70, we all have degeneration in our joints. And if you're doing a lot of squatting and lunging, the back of your knee or your kneecap would usually be the first places to go. So my guess is that squatting and the lunging, if you're going down to 90, is overloading the structures in the back of your knee. So
there you go,
Jill.
Yep, I agree. I think those are all good plans. We want to keep you active, keep you moving, and maybe that slight modification in your lunge in your squats will decrease how much load you're putting back there. The deeper you go, the more we kind of shift our load onto the back of our knee, and sometimes it just can't take it.
And frankly, unless you're, you know, I don't know what you do for a living, most people don't need that strength in that range. You're going to get carryover of at least 15 degrees. So if you squat to 70 degrees, you'll be covered to 90.
Yep.
Doug, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jill Tine-Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program. One of our guests, the other, Lori Tine-Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. I'm Larry Mueller. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here taking a look at physical therapy issues today with our two guests, Jill Tine-Nissenbaum and Lori Tine-Brody. Always great to have them come by to visit about your aches and your pains and sprains and strains, among other things. We've also talked about telemed, and certainly looking forward to your own questions as we move along. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Speaking of telemed, Matt from Wausau emailed and said, in his experience, telemed costs the same as an in-person visit, and he's wondering why that is the case.
Lori, do you want to? That's a great question.
So because it's continuing to use the physical therapist's skilled services during that time, so it is the decision-making, it's the examination, whether it's visual over telemed or verbally by subjective, it's the documentation and so on. So it's the professional services that are provided. So whether it's face-to-face or telemed, it's still utilizing the physical therapist skill set for that service. So for us at UW, so UW determines our charging, and we are governed by the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, who provide guidelines on what we can or cannot charge for our services, including telemed. So we follow the guidelines provided by the federal government. But again, it's professional services, whether it's delivered face-to-face or face-to-face via a video service.
Yeah, it's a half hour or an hour either way. So
yeah, of a right. professional's yeah. time. So
right. Yep.
Betsy and Ripon, we'll go to you now. Hi, Betsy.
Well, good morning. I'm calling for my daughter, who's looking for a mattress actually right now, and she was calling about they're really pushing the kind of mattress that bends up from behind you and then or your foot. I forgot what they're called. And she has
sleep back, number, I think.
Lumbar C3 or anyway lower back, I guess. Uh-huh. She wondered if they help.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the thing is, with pillows and wedges and things like that, you can probably position yourself. You can probably position yourself similar to what that bed does. And probably may frankly have more options than it, if you buy a flat mattress and buy a bunch of wedges and things like that instead. I don't know that I would invest a lot of money in all the mechanics that go into that unless you're absolutely certain that you would utilize those frequently when you slept. Lori, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that. Now, that being said, for people who say, when I am sleeping at night and I can't get to sleep and my back pain wakes me up and I go out to my recliner,
right,
and I can sleep like a baby in my recliner, then maybe that positioning is the right positioning for you. But as Jill said, a flat mattress with a topper, a firm mattress, and I like a body pillow.
Mm-hmm.
They have these U-shaped body pillows. I think that work nicely, that give you additional sleep positions besides stomach, side, back. It allows you to lie in what we call front side lying and back side lying, so it gives you additional sleeping positions. For many people, that works well. But like I said, if you get your very best sleep in a recliner, then potentially that kind of bed is the right one for you.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So she just needs to know what position or positions work best for her and then see if that mattress can meet her needs.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, you want to purchase a mattress where you can return it in 30 days if it doesn't work for you.
Right.
There you go, Betsy.
You don't want an all sales or final thing.
And rotate your mattress.
Every month for the first,
for the first 6 months.
Yeah. There you go, Betsy. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And I don't think you can rotate those every month for 3 months.
Oh, so. No, I don't think those rotate at all.
No,
right, no, that would be one that you would not be able to rotate. That is correct.
Yeah. Betsy, again, thank you. Elisa in Onalaska, your turn. Hi.
Hi. So I'm an Olympic weightlifter, and I've always had issues with my right hip since high school, and I used to run cross country. But pretty much, like, my left leg has, I think I use our in-body scan, and it has like a pound and a half difference, and it's visibly bigger. And my right leg is the one that always has all the issues. I've gone in before, and I've really worked with doing like adductor strengthening and abductor strengthening too. But it's just so, my external rotation is just so horrible on it. I didn't know if you guys had any more maybe stretches or exercises or something I can do to increase that mobility.
So your left leg, when you say, so you've been in a DEXA scanner and your lean mass is greater on your left leg?
Yes. Yeah, it's, yes.
Okay,
and it's visibly a lot larger as well, too.
Okay. And when you say it's bigger, is it in the quadriceps and hamstring area? Is it more glutes? Can you, I'm just trying to pinpoint kind of where you think your deficits lie on your right.
So on my left leg, I would say it's my, it's like my medial quad area, I would say for sure.
Okay. All right. So more quadriceps, like vastus medialis, that big muscle on the front, you're thinking.
Yep. That's okay. What I would say.
Okay. All right. So, and when you do your Olympic lifts, obviously you're doing the ones where you're doing everything bilaterally, right? So both feet are on the ground, right?
Yep. Yeah. And okay. Then also, yep.
Have you, since it sounds like you have access to fancy pants things, has anyone looked at how much you load each leg while you're doing that? Do you think you load evenly is the $1 million question.
I am pretty sure I do not load evenly. So my roommate is a graduate from the UW lacrosse PT program.
Oh, nice.
And I was able to kind of go in and some of the technology there we were kind of looking at. But I'm positive that I do not load evenly.
Okay. And so do you think you don't load evenly because you don't have the mobility in your hip? Is that what this is coming down to? Like, I don't load enough because I don't have enough range of motion in my hip? Or do you think it's pain, or tell us, what do you think is limiting you?
I don't think it's pain.
Okay.
I've worked on putting a band outside of my knees to try to get that stimulus suppressing.
Yep. Beautiful.
We really are trying to work on it a lot. It's been a work in progress, but
So you've lost external rotation. Is that what you're saying?
I have.
Okay.
And it's the one where my left leg does amazing external rotation and then my right leg doesn't.
Okay. And you were in cross country in high school?
I did cross country and field events. And that's when I really started to notice it. I started getting cortisone shots in my leg when I was in high school. And
In your hip?
Yep. In my hip.
Okay. So how many cortisone shots did you have in your hip as a teenager?
Two.
Okay.
One for each year. I did one a year.
One for each year. Okay.
And which was
how
worse?
How long ago was that?
How did it go?
How old are you? That's what we're shooting for.
I'm 25, and I got it when I was like 15.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I mean, so who else has examined this hip? Have you had it scanned?
I've not had it scanned, but I'm very interested in.
That would be my next stop. I don't know about you, Jill,
I know what you're thinking.
You know where I'm going. I have
you know where you're going.
Bilateral hip labral tears.
Yeah.
So you did field events. So you know, if you're throwing a discus, you're in a lot of external rotation.
All the rotation and pivoting on that leg.
So I would say my next stop would be having that hip scanned. I'd start with plain radiographs, and then I would want an MRI looking for a labral tear. Because if you've lost external rotation and you're only 25. You need this looked at sooner rather than later, and you have that much of a difference in your strength side to side. This will only worsen as you age.
Right.
That's my best advice.
But there you go.
Having said all that, I do think the band around your leg to engage your gluteus medius and glute max with activity is really important. So I would definitely continue to do that. We know that women in particular have a harder time activating their gluteal muscles than men. And so that band can help increase activity in your glute med and your glute max. So I would certainly continue to do that in the meantime, but I would get some imaging done. You need some baseline imaging done. You've been fighting this long enough.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, thanks, Elisa, for calling. Chuck wonders about if you have any advice about dealing with neck arthritis. Any exercises? He was also wondering if they might recommend a specific type of pillow.
That's a longer conversation. So there are a number of exercises for neck arthritis. So A, we want to make sure that you maintain sufficient mobility in your neck, that is rotating side to side, up and down, and side bending. One of the things you have to be careful of anywhere along the spine is if you have arthritis at one or two segments, what tends to happen is you don't move at those segments and you increase the mobility above and below those arthritic segments. So then you tend to start wearing out the segments above and below your arthritic segments. So that being said, we like to see those people and make sure that they're moving at every level and watching them move and feeling them move and make sure that they are moving appropriately. And then doing strengthening to support the muscles in their neck.
Yeah, that makes sense. So an in-person visit there probably. Well, we have Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum as our guests today, and they'll be with us right up till 12:30 to talk physical therapy issues. Jill, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Lori is a physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Take a look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. And then we will be back. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. And we are talking physical therapy today with two guests, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program, and Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist and an athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Here to answer your questions about physical therapy, lots of callers online already. The number is 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And because we have lots of callers, let's go to the phones and to Tom in Appleton. Tom, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm 54. I started running roughly around 40, and about 4 to 5 years ago, I had some foot pain due to I had a dorsal chylectomy performed on my big toe, and initially they recommended hydrocortisone for taking care of some of the pain, and so I'm trying to understand. I never had that done, and since then I've been working back into running. I'm up to 3 days a week for 3 miles. My question is the hydrocortisone supposed to help with a breakthrough, or what is the purpose of that versus just easing back into it?
Wow, that's a great question. So first of all, a chylectomy, for people who don't know, kind of removes excessive bone off your big toe. So it's on the dorsal side. So it would have been on the top of your toe, right?
Correct.
Okay. All right. And you only had it on one side?
Correct.
And did you have it?
That was due.
Okay, go ahead.
That was due to a accident.
Due to a wedding? What? Due
car.
To Oh, car
college.
Accident?
An accident in college.
Got it. Oh. Okay. Right. Okay. 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 That makes sense. Okay. So you had this excess bone removed, and then they gave you hydrocortisone cream.
No, they did not. I toughed it out and just have been gradually doing it, but I still have pain on that joint, both from walking and even running. Trying to understand, do I keep going down the self physical therapy route, or is there value in something like a hydrocortisone shot on that joint that'll help me break through something?
I think there's value in seeing a physical therapist. So, you know, as much load as you're putting through your toe, and your great toe is so important for walking and for running, for push-off, and to keep you active, I think getting the mechanics of your movement of your entire foot assessed in person by a physical therapist is very important, because what's probably happened is since you've had this procedure done, the load has changed through his first ray and his first great toe. Don't you think, Lori?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, so there was an accident, but the question is, what's the status of the arthritis of your great toe, that first MTP joint right now? And how have the mechanics of your foot changed, as Jill said? So it all boils down to how you're moving and how that joint is moving. The foot itself is made up of a multitude of small joints, and it's very easy to compensate for either pain or a subtle loss of mobility at that joint, which I'm expecting that you had. And then what happens is then you load either other parts of the joint or other parts of the foot, and you're just robbing Peter to pay Paul. So I think it makes sense to see somebody face-to-face, as Jill suggested, and get that looked at, get it examined, examine your mechanics, examine your mobility, and they can fine-tune whatever you're doing at home to make sure you're doing the right things.
And if you can't get over the hump with that, then an injection may be indicated, but I think that's probably a good first place to start.
There you go, Tom. Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. We have Jane, who is a cross-country runner. She's 17 and suffers shin splints and has them now, I suppose, getting ready for the season. What do you do about shin splints?
Well, we see this often, and there's so many variables that go into this. We can kind of go back to the Achilles tendonitis or tendinopathy conversation we had with Peter about this. You know, it could be too much, too soon, too fast, because we know that a lot of people, especially high school kids, may kind of put off their training until it's too late, and then they might have a rapid increase in their activity, which may cause shin splints. And shin splints, just so you know, is kind of a garbage can term for any shin pain on the front or inside of your calf. It may be her running surface. It may be her shoe wear. There's many, many variables that could be impacting Jane's shins.
Absolutely. Too much, too fast. We break it down to intrinsic variables, and that is things specific to the athlete. Hip width, knee posture, foot posture, et cetera. And then we look at extrinsic variables, and those are usually the training variables. How much, how fast, surface, loading, volume, all those things. So, because of the number of variables, this tends to be a very individualized prescription. There is no one-size-fits-all. So, thus, a visit either face-to-face or a telemed visit, sorting through all these variables, I think would be really important.
Right, especially, you know, Jane probably is going to become a lifelong runner. So we want to keep her healthy and let her enjoy running for many years to come.
And so in the meantime, lay off the running, or what do you do?
So I may suggest some cross training, so do some running. I usually tell people to run up to but not through their shin splint. So if she's getting pain at mile 3, she could run 2 or 2.5. She can alternate some of the days with a non-impact activity such as biking. An ice massage or ice cup works really well. And then just make sure she's doing a lot of really good lower extremity flexibility or stretching, and not just for below the knee, but her hamstrings, her quadriceps. She should be doing a lot of that just to kind of get all of her muscles used to that increased load. The other thing we always think about is with cross country is, you know, you only move kind of in one plane, and that sagittal plane. So getting her to do some sort of activity that kind of mixes things up and is multi-planar, loads her legs a little bit differently, would also be a good idea for her.
All right. Well, let's take another call. Pat in Wauwatosa, it's your turn now. Hi, Pat.
Hello. Listen, I have my left, I don't know if I should say hip or below my waist, my left cheek pain, and then sometimes it goes down my thigh and the back or even my ankle. But it comes and goes. Now, my right hip has been replaced, and I have it's always my left side that, and I don't know, would this be sciatica or... I'd hoping you'd say, oh, go get a cortisone shot.
Go get a cortisone shot. Your cortisone does not fix everything, sadly. So when do you get these symptoms? Is there any pattern to when these symptoms arise?
Well, if I walk more, and I live in a building where I try to do the stairs once a day, just one flight, and putting my foot weight on my left leg going up or down isn't so bad, but it just increases as I walk sometimes. That's my main exercise. I should have mentioned I'm 91, and I really like to walk a little bit, but and this has come and gone. It comes and goes, I should say.
Okay. So is it when you're walking and when you're doing the stairs when you put your left foot forward?
When I do the stairs, and even when I get up, I'm aware immediately of this pain in my left rear. And if I'm on my feet or walking more, it just increases sometimes. And by the end of the day, it might be, you know, down my thigh or even my ankle hurts a little.
Yeah, you know, that sounds like a fairly classic sciatic symptom.
It does. It does.
Uh-huh. Now, that being said, it can come from several different places. It could be coming from your back, in which case we address activities at your back, some mobility exercises, some stretching, some postural retraining, looking at how you do things. It all could also be originating in your cheek that you described, because your sciatic nerve passes through your cheek and through some muscles, and sometimes some muscles in your butt can aggravate that. And I would say if you're having more issues with stairs, that might be the case, because you're really invoking those when you push yourself up the stairs.
Yeah.
So seeing a PT for one or two visits to sort out the source of this and then giving you potentially just a couple things to help treat this might help keep you going. In the meantime, continue walking on a level surface and potentially think about shortening up your stride.
Right. And the other thing that could be causing this is just, I don't know how long ago your total hip was, Pat, but the question is, are you overloading your left side because of some long-term weakness in that right side when you had your total hip? Did you say that, Lori?
No, I didn't say that, so thank
you.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that might be another thing that just... Another variable to consider. So there's lots of different things to look at. But, boy, it sounds like you're very active for 91, which is fabulous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Pat. Good luck. Appreciate it. Well, let's see. We have Tim in Milwaukee next. Hi, Tim.
Hello. I just wanted to call you guys. I used to compete in powerlifting at a national level, like in the 900-pound squat on the 220-pound frame. Did that for like 15 or 20 years. On top of that, a truck driver. Now I'm 47 years old. I went back and got an education. I'm not doing the physical labor anymore, and I quit powerlifting cold turkey, like I said, in 07. And I just got, you know, every joint herniated, you know, disc. But the big one right now, it's pretty much something all the time, is sleeping with my shoulders. It's kind of like Rice Krispies in my shoulders anytime I move, and then I just get woken all through the night. Not with the numbness and tingling so much, because I've already had the carpal tunnel and carpal tunnel surgeries, but this is more the just pain in my shoulders, you know. And I'm wondering if there's any kind of range of motion or any kind of light exercise or something I could do to help rehabilitate these shoulders a little bit.
So is it when you're sleeping in a particular position that your shoulders hurt? So is it if you lay on the shoulder, or is it, can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, so it's usually if I'm on my back or either side, either shoulder, left and right, you know, like I said, the whole body is kind of in a at 47 now, pretty much. It's a tough shape, but yeah, any position of sleep, I can't sleep on my stomach with these shoulders.
Okay.
But, sides or back is usually where I end up. And I guess the sides, if I go either to the left or the right side, I'm probably going to have more pain. It's hard to stay right on the back all night.
Sure. I think talking about positioning, one of the things that Lori talks about is not being completely on your side or completely on your back, but that quasi position, Lori, might be a good strategy for him.
Yeah. Well, the question is, where is this shoulder pain coming from? So it's unusual for someone to be able to sleep on their sides rather than their stomach when they have shoulder pain. Usually people with primary shoulder pain, the first complaint is they cannot sleep on that side. So when you're sleeping on your stomach, what position is your head and neck in?
So when I say sleeping on my side, I can't sleep like with my arm up on my side. There's no way, but like on my back to the side a little bit is how I have to go to get through the night. So either the left, you know, a little bit, or the right a little bit, but mainly on the back. I can't go to the front or completely on the side either way.
Okay. Okay. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's still also possible that it could be coming from your neck. So, you know, given your history, I would not rule out neck as the source of your shoulder pain. It tends to rear its ugly head at night. So I guess my recommendation would be, given your history and the extensive load you have placed on your body over the years, I'd want to get an exam to see what the source of your pain is. So in terms of sleeping, as Jill said, that body pillow where you're doing back side lying or front side lying might be a comfortable position. But I think also, given your young age and the number of years you have to live with these joints, it would also be worthwhile to be seen and have your neck examined as well as your shoulders to see if your neck is contributing to your shoulder pain or if it's a primary shoulder problem.
Right. And a primary shoulder problem, it could be the glenohumeral joint, the ball and socket itself, mm-hmm. or it could also be the AC joint, because we know that with excessive lifting, you can end up with a lot of AC joint pathology as well. So I think there's like you said, Lori, there's multiple things to consider here. And yeah. as young as you are, and you still want to maintain, you know, some good activity in your life, let's preserve these joints as best we can and make sure that we can get you in an optimal sleep position.
There yeah. you go, Tim. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Seal in Menominee, Wisconsin, it's your turn. Hi, Seal.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Can sure. you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay. So I will try to be quick with this. I'm right-handed. I have a wrist kind of injury or discomfort, and the only thing I can attribute it to is cross-country skiing and, like, pulling with my pole, mm-hmm. like my hand and my fist around my pole. And mm-hmm. I was trying to beat my husband, so I was trying to go really hard and really fast. And so that didn't help. Didn't have any discomfort right away, but before the ski season got done, I started to have this discomfort below my thumb, but above my wrist bone. So, like, there's a little indentation there.
Yeah, the cuff box. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so to pull my thumb away from my hand or to lift something heavy, say, out of the oven, that mm-hmm. weight, it's very unstable, and it's just, it doesn't hurt when I'm doing nothing. It's fine. But the minute I try to rotate that thumb and use that, it's kind of a twingy, sharp pain. And
okay.
Yeah. I didn't do anything about it at the time, because going into the hospital, it was right around the time
right.
the virus
sure.
cases were surging. So it was like, you know,
sure,
I'm sure
right.
it'll get better.
So if
but
you
I still have to beat him eventually.
Of course. Yeah. That is our priority here. That is number one priority. We totally understand.
I like how you're planning ahead here.
Right. So, Neil, if you make a fist and you put your thumb inside your fist, and then bend your wrist so you're bringing your pinky side of your wrist towards your wrist. Does that hurt?
Bend your wrist towards your pinky side.
Yeah, bend your wrist towards
yeah.
your pinky side. Is that
yep,
your pain?
That's exactly where the pain is.
Well, there mm-hmm. you go.
See, telemedicine works really well.
Uh-huh. We didn't even have to see you. That's called Descuervain's tenosynovitis. We just did the Finkelstein test. Really long words for
tendonitis of very specific thumb stabilizer. So probably when you were grabbing your pole, when you were pulling for cross country and you gripped really hard and used that thumb to stabilize, especially if you had your wrist bent in a very particular way when you were pulling, which you would, you probably gave yourself a nice little overuse injury. We see it oftentimes in hairdressers who hold the scissors and have to pinch with that scissors and kind of put their wrist in awkward position. So it's called De Quervain's tenosynovitis, and it's an overuse of those tendons in your hand. And to
so
treat
I
it,
see,
you want to talk
to yeah. I'd see a hand therapist.
Yep.
Okay, so you would say, you would recommend to have it be seen.
Yeah. I put this in the same category as, especially if you're right-handed and it's your dominant hand, as those tendinopathies that take a long time to heal. So the Achilles tendonitis we talked about earlier, that patellar tendonitis, it's really hard to get it to rest. So a hand therapist who could be either a physical therapist or an occupational therapist, both are very capable in that area. It's kind of a nice subspecialty, may give you a wrist splint or a thumb spica splint to kind of immobilize it to let those tendons rest and give you very specific exercises to make sure everything is strong, get the inflammation under control, et cetera.
Cassiel, if this was going to get better on its own,
it would have.
It's August. It would be better by now. So if you're really serious about beating your husband, you need to start dealing with this now. All right.
Cecile, is that...
Thank you so much for your help.
you're up for that. Okay. Oh, my goodness me. Well, yeah, this beating the spouse is probably in a race, not beating on the spouse.
Right. There's priorities here.
There's priorities. Oh, my goodness me. Well, we had listeners, 57-year-old woman has been walking 5 miles a day for decades. She noticed last year while picking weeds in the front yard, she had extreme difficulty getting up off the ground. Says it's like the muscles that are used to rise to a sitting or standing position no longer work. Any thoughts on that
in the last minute or so? Yep. So remember that muscles are very specific to the activity that they perform. So what I mean by that is walking 5 miles a day is wonderful, stupendous exercise, but it's not working your muscles the same way as getting up off the ground or getting out of a chair or getting in and out of a car. Your exercise is very specific to that task. It's why you can be in great shape for long distance running, but you go play a game of tennis, you're going to be sore because you're using your muscles differently. The ability to get up and down off the ground independently is a very good predictor of frailty. So I would strongly encourage listeners to practice getting in and out of chairs. It's called a sit-to-stand test. So every day, sit-to-stand 6 to 10 times. Practice getting up and down off the floor, both with the assistance of furniture and without. And if she is having specific weakness, she might consider a visit or two to a physical therapist to get some instruction in some specific strengthening exercises for those muscles.
Right, exactly.
And with that, we are out of time. Thank you so much, Jill and Lori. Really always appreciate your time. And you're back on September 21st. We'll do it
again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jill Tine-Nissenbaum, Associate Professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy Program at UW-Madison. Lori Tine-Brody, Physical Therapist and Athletic Trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. And they'll be back on September 21st. Tomorrow, we'll be joined by a Wisconsin professor about her new book, all about the complex experience of getting older. In the meantime, thank you very much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots more in store. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.